WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
These are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
And I think it'd be interesting to really try to unravel what his ties.
There's a sort of country-city divide.
They're inconvenient, and it's not clear where it goes next.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Nicholas Niarchos is a contributor to The New Yorker, and he has the challenging beat of reporting on a war that, frankly, many Americans don't even know we're involved in. The war in Yemen is both a civil war and a regional war with more powerful neighbors, Iran and Saudi Arabia, involved. At the same time, the United States is supporting and enabling the Saudis' air war. Hundreds of thousands of people have fled Yemen, and many are in Djibouti in eastern Africa. Nick Niarchos visited one of the refugee camps there in 2016.
Okay, 50. So should we go one like that and one of the other ones over there?
The camp in Djibouti was hot and dusty, and people were miserable. But Nick met a man there who had a unique way of coping with tragedy and finding beauty wherever he could.
So it's in the middle of the desert. You arrive at the camp. It's incredibly, incredibly hot. When you walk out of an air-conditioned room into this heat, you feel like you're going to be physically sick. But you don't really smell anything because it's so hot. All your senses are overwhelmed by the heat, and everybody's looking for shade. So you walk through the camp, and people come up to you and say that they want to talk to you about different things. They want to complain about, you know, not having air conditioning or not having adequate food. And these are all really serious concerns. But at one point, this man approached me, and he was smiling.
Lovely, isn't it?
And laughing. And I didn't really understand, you know, what there was to smile and laugh about. And he said,
My place in morning early is very, very nice. I wish if you come.
He said, you must come to my tent. You have to come and see my tent. Walk down this way. He pointed towards the Aden sector. And he said, you'll go to this place and you'll hear the birds singing. And then you'll have arrived at my tent.
You will be surprised when you see my free birds all around my fencing. They found the freedom. They found somebody who to feed them. I show you, come on. Please, sorry. I have different kinds of food.
His name is Abdullahi Bashrahil, and I hadn't been invited into somebody's house like that. People have come and said, you know, I want to speak to you about this and I want to speak to you about that. But this was just somebody inviting me to see what he'd built in the camp.
Sorry, that's my gate.
I see. Thank you very much.
We went through a low gate.
Wow, it's really quite a collection around here.
And the fence was sort of posts joined by wire, and then there were sort of skulls hanging on the wire and pieces of wood and, you know, doll's arms and various different sort of bits and bobs, basically, that he'd collected from the desert.
So, this is a civilian museum. Look, this.
So walking into the museum, there's one tent which covers a series of plants that Bashar Hill is growing.
Oh, wow, this is... So you've got a whole garden in here.
Yes.
What sort of
green pepper, uh-huh, and bidingal. I don't know what you call in English. And that's
and
all.
There like is a little sort of day bed in the middle of the museum. And you look around and it's completely different from everywhere else in the refugee camp. I've been thinking about this a lot since I came back, because it's this quality of sort of being inside a place that's walled off in this incredibly harsh climate, and suddenly you feel like you're in this little garden and this little oasis and this little paradise, and the rest of the world kind of melts away outside.
I will show you something. Look, I remember now. A saw.
Bashar Hill could sound crazy to people, but he's actually somebody who doesn't really come off as crazy when you meet him. He just kind of bowls you over with this great deal of energy. But he definitely is eccentric.
A saw.
Oh, wow. It's a very, very small sword.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Why do you keep it in water like that?
No, it is not water. Oh. It's, gas and oil. Because if it's gold, when you keep it for several weeks, it became shining.
Well, he's a funny guy, and he, I was trying to ask him about his life before the camp, and he would always sort of crack these little jokes.
Can you tell me a bit about your life when you were in Adan as a child?
When I was as a child,
yeah, for your life beforehand.
More handsome than you.
I'm sure.
I was very, very, very handsome. And I was also very, very bad. I am very bad because God make me very soft.
Okay.
This is my problem. I am a soft person. This is my problem.
Bashar Hill worked as a road surveyor in Yemen, and he worked for a lot of Western companies. And he was actually a successful and pretty well-educated guy. He is a 63-year-old man. He doesn't have a wife. He doesn't have kids. He's from a sort of a well-known Yemeni family, but he's not independently wealthy particularly. He lived in Aden in the Mualla district, and he had built a good life for himself.
Tell me about your life in Adan.
In Adan.
Before the war.
Before the war. It was very, very, very good. Until they started the war. We became like animals.
He escaped in April of last year.
Discrimination.
He didn't have anything. He had the shirt on his back, and he had a pair of trousers.
We became like slaves.
He arrived by himself, and he has made do in this camp ever since.
So thanks for God that I'm in Djibouti. I reach this place.
Bashar Hill has suffered a great deal. You know, he's lost his home, he's lost his country, he's been displaced, and he feels like he can never go back. And that's something that profoundly affects somebody.
So how come And how come to live with people like that? The government in their hands.
Because of that, he tried to sort of root himself in this new place that he's found himself in. And he's tried to sort of leave a mark there. And I think this is kind of, he's planting trees and he's built this little museum.
That's a bomb.
That's a bomb. Exactly.
It's a sort of smallish, a mortar shell, really.
This is, you know, this.
It's a larger 50 caliber bullet.
Yeah, bullet, yeah. This.
That's an unused bullet.
Yes.
7.62, probably, from a Kalashnikov.
He used to be a road surveyor in Yemen, and he is very, very aware of distance, and he's got a very good sense of distance, and he walks for 20 kilometers every day by himself. He only walks by himself. And looks at the ground and picks up objects.
This is, you know, you can anyhow seat
a pestle and mortar.
Yes. This is an old radio. It's no use to bring it, but I like everything is old and new. I found it in the garbage. I add to my museum. Look, and this for.
He's not just a collector. He is an artist. He had this artist sensibility of
I will show you something.
Wanting to leave his mark and wanting to kind of improve things by piecing material parts of his world together.
And this is an eagle face. Look, eagle face. I make it from stone, and when you go a few meters from far away from it, it looks like an eagle face.
You know, like from stone and wood.
It looks like wing. Huh? And this is the face of the eagle, you know.
If somebody were to act like this in you know, New Mexico, they could be called a found objects artist. But this is somebody in a refugee camp in Djibouti.
There is another story. Why I escaped?
Everything that he had in this life was taken away from him by the war. But he's a hopeful guy.
There were two birds here.
Bashir Hill had two birds. He showed me the cage.
And I was looking to them.
And he said
there is a third bird
that one day he looked over at the cage and there was a third bird sitting there looking at the two other birds.
I looked, his eyes seem, he's very sad. He seemed crying.
He said that this was, this affected him, and he didn't want to keep these two birds caged. And he said, I free you for the sake of God, and opening the cage, letting the birds into the sky.
By chance, in the same day where I freed the birds, they told me the ambassador of USA will visit you.
So the ambassador was coming, and Bashir Hill thought, what am I going to say? What am I going to do? How am I going to welcome him into my museum and show that this is a sort of big occasion?
I said, how can I greet him? I have no birds. I have only chicken.
And
he
found two other birds. And when the American ambassador arrived, he released the two birds into the sky as a sort of message of greeting.
I said to him, greeting you, you know, and let the birds to fly.
Bashir Hill releasing these two birds might seem to us like a very sweet gesture, and it was. But it was also a sacrifice, because these birds are a very valuable commodity within the camp. And he, in doing this, showed a great deal of respect for the ambassador. And when I called the ambassador, he was effusive in telling me how touched he had been by the warmth of Bashir Hill's greeting, and how interested he had been to look around the museum. And While he had been there, Bashar Hill told him about a dream that he had, which was to be resettled in the United States or somewhere in Europe and to build a new museum. And he thought that by making his case to the ambassador, he would stand a better chance of being repatriated. The tragedy of the situation is that the ambassador is not in charge of refugee resettlement. It just seems to me a very, very long shot that he will be coming here.
After when I saw his reply, I don't want to talk too much. He smiled. I know his smile. He's keeping for me something. Maybe one day he will collect me. And I don't know, maybe soon. He's ambassador.
That's Abdullahi Bashrahil, a refugee from Yemen. He spoke with Nicholas Niarchos of The New Yorker in 2016. And Nick will be back on the show next week with more reporting on the war in Yemen and its human costs. That's next time. For today, we're going to close the show with the poet Tracy K. Smith. The first poem of Smith's we published in The New Yorker was a poem about Levon Helm, the drummer and singer of the band, which warmed my heart. And not too many years after that, in 2017, she was named the Poet Laureate of the United States. With signs of spring beginning to creep up, at least here in the Northeast, Tracy offered to take us on a little journey near her home into the woods.
We are at my home in Princeton, New Jersey right now, and we're heading into what is known as the common land or the common wood that sits in this neighborhood, which is called the Gray Farm neighborhood. And that's my dog, who's jealous that she's not coming. And it leads out to Lake Carnegie. We're walking along like a bed of bark, this path, and there's some tree stumps that have been lined up to create like a little guide to the path. To the right, we see some of the houses that look out onto the lake. You can see the bridge up ahead, the cars going into town to the left. One of our neighbors planted, I think, thousands of daffodil bulbs, so we'll pass those. Some people have what my kids call bamboo forests. You'll see some neighbors up here have bamboo at the back of their property, and it's just kind of this open space. I loved being a young writer in New York and having my community of people and our sense of a hunger and excitement. And then I had kids, and my father died. So we left New York City and moved here. And I had a little bit of, I was anticipating having heartbreak about leaving Brooklyn, where I'd lived for so long and was so happy. And then I came here and I was like, oh my God, this is the real world. Like, there are these trees that are just electrically green. And I feel like something in me has changed as a result. Like I don't know, I feel like the trees are doing more than just giving oxygen. I think they're these old souls that kind of console in different ways. And so there's something beautiful about this as a backdrop of what feels like a new beginning or the beginning of what comes after youth. And maybe I feel sort of consoled by the fact that the landscape just keeps going despite all of the things that we do. That's really been the really most beautiful surprise of being here, how much silence and green space has fed the inner silence that I think most writers are seeking. I had a teacher once who, Linda Gregg, the poet Linda Gregg, who said, if you are suffering from writer's block, it's really just anxiety that's keeping you from being quiet. If you're quiet, after about 15 minutes, your mind is imaginative enough to come up with an idea to prevent boredom. And I feel it's so true. In my 20s, I couldn't write. I had so much anxiety about what people were saying, what my classmates and teachers were saying about what I was writing, that I just kind of stopped for about 9 months, which really hurt. And my strategy at that time was to take a photography class, just to be doing something creative and learning to look at things through that lens. And I think it helped bring me back to the page because I recognized something I hadn't quite articulated to myself before, which was that an image can do such amazing lyrical work, and it can free you from the need to make statements and explain. If you can just describe, a feeling can emerge that the reader can't help but participate in. And before that, I thought poems were a series of wise statements that someone who had discovered things laid out one after another. And so I was, no wonder I had writer's block. I could figure out maybe one thing that seemed genuinely interesting, and then a couple of other things that were in imitation of a wise person, and then I couldn't get past that. The first thing I want to look for is something that has to do with a bird or something natural. I feel like there's an effortless sense of clarity that I can locate in some of those types of sources. Yeah, sometimes what I know is, look, there's a deer. There are several. Oh, wow. No matter how many times you see one, you still get that same feeling of, oh, how lucky. I'm sorry, guys, I'm bothering you. Wow, I can't believe we made it back the way we came in. This almost never happens to me when I'm by myself. Hi, Coco.
The poet Tracy K. Smith. You can find some of her poems at newyorker.com, and she has a new book about to come out called Wade in the Water. And that's it for today. Thanks for joining us. I'm David Remnick. I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Calla Leah, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Terrence Bernardo, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.